I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about how you went about collecting the data in the you used for the experiment. It was one person at one time. Were they tired? Were they? There are other factors. You sort of mentioned, is there one different from another? But there seems to be a lot of factors that would affect similar kinds of detection mechanisms, and I wonder if you've started to explore that space.
Right. So certainly we did not collect all the data all the ones. In fact, the three data sets are, so we have three data sets, and for each data set consists of multiple sessions. So in each session, the user types somewhere between 5 to 50 keys. So the numbers are actually in the paper. So they're collected across even one data set is collected across multiple days.
Patrick Trainer, Georgia Tech. First, shameless plug. I think this is a cool problem. And we have a paper similar to this, except that we place the phone next to a keyboard and can actually recover keystrokes, and that'll be at CCS later this year. The second is, did you think about handedness? I wonder if.
Sorry, I didn't hear.
Did you think about handedness? For example, it seemed that your scent was the hardest to identify, and I wonder if that was because if someone is right-handed and holding the phone on their left, the 7 is in sort of a pretty solid place, so the phone's really not shaking around. It may not have any interesting characteristics. I wonder, for example, could you tell the handedness of the user just by looking at the data set?
That's a great idea. In fact, the handedness we consider that as a part of the factors that in our ongoing user study to see whether that is going to be a factor. Yeah, but that's a great idea.
Hi, I'll move over. Hi, Nathan Taylor, UBC. Just a quick question, in the similar style to the first two. You were assuming that the phone is not being held while someone is walking. Do you have any idea how you might be able to compensate for motion, say if you're on a bus or if you're walking along and you're bobbing like this? Did that make sense? Like, because it seems like if you're holding it perfectly still, then that becomes simpler than if you're sort of moving about as you're walking down the street.
Right. So the question is that what if you are not standing still? What if you are riding the bus? In our experiments, we never did that. But we think that that should not be a problem, because when you're typing, the frequency of the motion is way higher than the motion of the bus. So if anything, by applying maybe a high pass filter, we think that that would be able to get rid of the motion caused by riding a bus. However, if you are on a roller coaster while typing, then that might be a different story.
Thanks.
Yeah, Rick Farrow. My question is for Jason. So I was curious, you've got a client-side protection mechanism, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. It's totally on the client.
Right.
But it is kernel level, so...
Yes.
To get around it, you do need a kernel-level exploit, which is not impossible.
Right.
But you also have to have some way of managing which data is sensitive.
So in our current implementation, that's all defined by either the user or the administrator. You have to manually go in and mark an entire directory or a specific file or something as sensitive.
You're a little quiet.
In our current implementation, that's all manually defined. You have to go in and mark an entire directory or a specific file as sensitive.
But this is just for file operations. So if I things like cutting and pasting, I could still export data.
Right.
Okay. I was just curious. Yeah, just that it's on the client side seemed a little. I know it's interesting. It's a different approach, but I wonder how well it's going to work. Because you have all these management issues as well.
Right.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Some others?
Yeah. Sorry. Kevin Butler, University of Oregon. So this is a question for Jason as well. Your approach of interposition on system calls and a diversity of
of outputs seems reminiscent of the invariant systems work that Dave Evans' group did. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how your system, how you see this as being as differing, and whether the approach they use.
What was his work again? I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
The invariant systems.
I'm not sure if I'm very familiar with.
I should probably cede the floor to Dave to explain it better than I can, but. Is there somewhere?
Go ahead.
I have to remember the paper, so. The concept of, in that paper, was looking at it in the context of malware, of essentially having subtle variations in a system, and having multiple systems that you would plug the same inputs through, and essentially looking at the output, seeing if there was anomalous output, if that was evidence of potential malware on the system.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds similar, but I guess we're trying to do that on a network level. So, you know, we're looking for anomalous outputs to the network, not for a specific machine.
Do you see it as being generalizable then for finding malicious things as well as being an information flow tracking mechanism?
I haven't thought about it in the context of like malware like that, but that is an interesting point.
I have a question about the keystroke logger. So it seems to me you have a very easy test for your system because you only have a numeric keyboard and it's pretty large on the screen, right?
Yes.
And so as you go to the real keyboard where numbers, some letters are close together, you'll have much more trouble telling them apart. Did you think about using some kind of a language model to, it won't work for passwords, uh-huh. but it might work for free text data?
So. Yes, I totally I agree with you on every aspect. So that's why we choose only the number-only keyboard on smartphone. However, we think that if we use a full keyboard on a smartphone, maybe we're not able to predict the exact keystroke, but maybe we can narrow down the search space. Maybe we can say that this keystroke is one of the five key in that region. So that's one point. Another point is that as tablet devices become popular, such as iPad or Motorola Zoom, then we believe that it's feasible to do this detection on a full keyboard on those tablet devices, because even on that device, each key is larger than a number-only key on a smartphone. And definitely, if your goal is not to recover the password, if your goal is to try to capture natural language, then definitely the language model would greatly help. Yeah, thank you.
I have a question. So do you see it changing between devices, like an iPhone versus an iPad, or like the weight of the device?
Yeah. Tell me about this. Our first experiment didn't work out very well because of the sensor. So the sensor, the precision, the frequency of the events, and the stability of the value vary a lot. And in fact, there are two different sensors. There's this accelerometer and there's this gyroscope. On one phone, one works better than the other. On another phone, it's the other way around.
Go ahead.
Me here, UBC. I was wondering whether you had any intuition on. I know a lot of these Android devices have swipe keyboards, so you never actually press the key, but you just draw something. Whether you had some kind of intuition as to whether you could have a motion which did it on a word basis, kind of corresponding to the pattern which gives a swipe word. You could have a motion of the phone which gave you a swipe word rather than a per character basis.
Sorry, could you repeat your question?
I know a lot of these phones have these swipe keyboards where you just draw something as you move and it does it on a word that has a kind of pattern on a keyboard associated with a word. Whether you have any intuition, I don't know whether you've looked at it at all, but as to whether some kind of motions of a phone could give you a word because if people were using that kind of a keyboard, whether, you'd have a fast move to the left followed by a right was likely a slide across or something like that corresponding to the patterns.
I think you're asking whether a trajectory would give you more information. Yeah, definitely.
But on a full word basis, say, rather than a character by character basis, because people will be doing it on a full word basis.
Yes, so the trajectory would give us more information. But on the other hand, if you rely on the trajectory, then one of the questions asked earlier, say, if you are riding a bus, so there's motion, because I think that the trajectory is a lot more low frequency than typing. So if you stand still, yes, that will give you more information. But if you're riding a bus, then that'll be less likely to be picked out from the background motion data.
Thanks.
We had someone here.
Hello. Adam Drew from Qualcomm. This is questions to the first speaker.
I'm having trouble hearing you.
This question is to the first speaker. Does every computer on the network have to have sort of duplicated processes?
Yes.
For example, so the answer is yes?
Yes. Or at least right now in the way we have it designed.
Okay, so how do you connect just regular laptops or just regular desktop machines to this network?
Yeah, we haven't really explored that aspect of it yet.
Okay.
Like how to support either like an incremental deployment of it or, you know, machines running, you know, non-modified kernel.
So this sounds like a pretty safe network at the moment. It hasn't got anything connected to it. But yeah, I think that'll be one of the major problems is you'll have to deal with the fact that lots of devices are going to connect to this network, and that's actually where a lot of the data leakage occurs. A secure device connects, people use data for their work purposes, then that computer leaves the network or is connects to another network, and the data sort of has leaked that way.
Hi, back here. Andy Warfield from UBC. I'm trying to understand, Jason, in your talk, around some of, you spent a bunch of time talking about determinism in terms of comparing the two things.
Right.
And I'm trying to understand how constrained you are in what applications can do with the data. It seems like as soon as there's any data-dependent control flow, right, if I feed Word a garbage document, it's going to crash or it's going to return an error that results in very different system calls from the good data.
Right.
So is it really sufficient to say that a file granularity thing is sensitive, or are you more constrained than that in what you can do practically?
I mean, I think this kind of gets back to the problem of how you scrub the data. Like, you want to scrub it in a way that you're not breaking the application, but that you're changing the actual data to something non-sensitive.
Okay, but is it just data that you're going to send verbatim over the network, basically, that you can scrub?
Say that again?
Is the only data that you can really scrub in the system data that you're going to send verbatim over the network? Is that sort of a good...
I mean, are you talking about, like, if you're encrypting the data or something?
If you're doing anything that involves reading the data and changing the way the program behaves.
I mean, I guess it depends really on the application. I mean, if it's just a text file or something. You know, I think it's really application dependent. And we haven't really explored what type of applications this would break.
Thanks.
So excuse me, Bill Aiello, UBC. I also have a question on the exfiltration paper. So I'm also trying to understand, so you have a model where, let's say you have trusted machines, they have trusted kernels, they can do this kind of split operation. I guess I'd like to hear you kind of compare and contrast, once you have that as a base assumption, other things you might do. So for example, you know, you're already assuming that trusted data is marked somehow. So, you know, it would seem like, well, and that at the end of the day, what you do when something looks like it's bad is you just don't send it out of the network. So if there was a request for something, just sort of no request comes back. It's just kind of dark. Mm-hmm. Why not, you know, the first time some processing on the network involves some trusted data, the trusted kernel just stops processing. I mean, that has the same net effect, that nothing gets back to the original requester. And other kinds of things where, you know, you just do kind of standard taint tracking because, as you said, you've already got some trusted, you've got a notion of what's sensitive data, you have a trusted kernel. Those kernels could talk to each other. Like, one trusted kernel could tell the gateway, you know, this guy, this request touched sensitive data. So can you just kind of compare and contrast your approach to other approaches that use the same set of assumptions?
So for your first point about just not sending the data, part of the problem is wherever the data is stored, you don't necessarily know who's requesting the data. So, I mean, you might have like a web server that's pulling data from a file server or something, and when the request comes in from some outside source, you know, the file server doesn't necessarily know that that's someone outside the network. So that's kind of one of the scenarios we were looking at, was where you have the data that might try to be tunneled through multiple machines or something. Sorry, what was the second point?
Wanted to compare and contrast with,
taint tracking. Yeah,
taint tracking, or you have a trusted kernel, right. So you can track sensitive data in other ways. I agree. Duplicating everything seems like a nice mechanism to not have to invent new mechanisms. You use existing mechanisms to do the tracking for you, but the overhead of that is duplicating everybody's work. And as you said, from the last question, you're going to have to invent kind of, methods for injecting stuff into applications that's application specific.
Right. As far as taint tracking, I mean, we're trying to design something that had a little bit lower overhead than taint tracking. Some approaches that have applied taint tracking to an entire network have overhead, you know, that's around 20 times. Or around that slowdown. So we're looking for something maybe that wasn't as fine-grained but had a little bit lower overhead.
Okay, thanks.
Seems there's also a difference in that taint tracking focuses on the mechanism of propagation of information, and your approach, these differential approaches, don't really care about the computation. They really focus on properties of the data at the get-go. And so they can potentially work with black box execution. I do, and maybe I'll go to my fodder here for discussion. I do think there's some challenges too. Let's see, what's the try? Good, there we go. PowerPoint. Right, so let me just frame some higher level things, and we can either go off on where these go or whatever. I think of the papers in this session as about how do we control our use of information, but with a real distinction between the first and third, which are about how do we keep information from going where we don't want it to go, and the second, which is about how do we understand the information we're receiving has the integrity we wish it to, and in particular, somewhat the programs we're going to execute. That's in the browser context. And it seems to me that these are control issues in both directions, right? One of them is how do we control where stuff goes, and the other is how do we, as designers, sort of get agreement on control of what ultimately gets executed. Right? So that the perspective of the browser, how does it control what it executes, so it has soundness. And I think both of those lead to ugly policy questions. Right? In fact, I was reading all three papers, I was struck at, the policy stuff is really the elephant in the room. That's my thing. And I'll identify a little of this. Right, and so how do we figure out what is indeed the points of sensitivity and what's the right granularity to operate? And how do we securely transform things so that they maintain the properties we want? And those are all vague, but I'll go briefly through the different papers here. So for the enterprise leakage, one thing I wanted to frame was that the PC was very fond of this topic. And thought, one of the discussions that the PC had was, wow, we could have just done a panel on this. That this problem of protecting against exfiltration in enterprises is just really important. Man, and really hard. And because it's so hard, anything that gives us little toeholds forward are good fodder to think about. So You know, my hit on the work you're representing is that the data scrubbing thing is very almost intractable, right? Because the problem is you can't have these parallel executions. You can't have one of them crash because the data is ill-formed. And yet you really don't know what it's going to try to do to it. So basically the data has to have the same semantics, the unsensitive data, as the sensitive data. That's kind of similar to the anonymization problem we face in data sets where we want to change, you know, what the representation of information into something semantically equivalent but sanitized. And we know that's really hard. So I think that that's a huge challenge. And related to it is, you know, well, how do we then decide what we're happy with in this transformation? So we take something with some semantics and we turn it into something else with same syntactic structure and different semantics, and then we got to decide what is safe in that regard. One thing I also wondered about was, because this problem here is so important, how are we going to move forward to something that we actually think is viable? Because part of, you know, as I was reading your work, was thinking, man, would this work for real? You know, if you could roll this out in a even a small enterprise, how much surprising divergence or semantic headaches like this would pop up? And I really don't know, and I don't know how to get any enterprise to let you try. You know, so I think there's just a challenge there for the community to think about how do we do research in this space, the space of exfiltration. Yeah.
Yeah, Rick Farrow. So a comment on that point is that there is a commercial product that actually, it's not doing exactly what you're doing at all, but it attempts to do the same thing. And it's, I believe the product is Vertices. Dan Gehr was one of the founders of the company, works only with Windows. They hook thousands of different, you know, Windows systems call. And the real bugaboo and what makes it so hard to use in an enterprise is there's so much management of what you need to control. So they can control level on, oh, you can cut and paste in this file, but you're not allowed to copy to a USB stick. So there's vast potential for control, but it's so vast that you can't actually do it. So that really becomes a big issue.
Sam?
So if it's okay, I'd like to take a step back before we talk about the more broad one. There's a comment back there. It was discussing the difference between dynamic taint analysis and something like this. And to me, the real difference here is if you look at something like mandatory access control, it's great because it works at the system call level, so it's really efficient to implement. And I think that's basically what he was saying. Like, look, you've got a trusted kernel, you use mandatory access control, and you're good to go. But the problem is then you're effectively, you know, implementing roles or you're tainting entire processes, and it's not giving you very fine granularity. So dynamic taint analysis will then give you more fine granularity, but you have like 40x overhead. And so basically what this approach is, I mean, Jason can say what, you know, maybe correct me, but to me, it seems like it's really trying to take some of the efficiency of looking at system calls, but giving you some of the more fine-grained attributes of dynamic taint analysis, but for this one specific policy, you know, I'm not going to leak any data. So maybe you've got your virus detection program, can check viruses or whatever, can go to the network and get updates as long as it's not sending your information out. At least that's what I got out of it. You know, obviously the author can.
No, that's right on.
I'd like to come back to what Rick said. Rick, did you, this product that you mentioned, how does it handle encrypted data in terms of, if the data is encrypted, if you encrypted it in transit or anything, how can it hook and understand and classify and prevent leakage?
Well, first, I'm not really an expert on this product. I've just heard what Dan Garrett's had to say about it on a list, and essentially, you know, if you have encrypted data, it does exist someplace in the system, right? And also, like, I don't know about the details. Suppose you get an encrypted file from a file server, and now you have this. You're really working on something in the file server. How does it carry the access control list along with it? I don't really know. The way I understand the system works is you have a document, and that document is labeled, and I believe the label can travel across the network because they've done all these hooks into the to the operating system.
Did you guys consider encrypted data in your work?
Yes, so we're actually trying to spun off the shadow process before encryption. That's why we're doing it at the read system call.
Because lots of stuff already uses encryption, right?
Right.
Any chance to become realistic? We should have.
It's taking place before the encryption, so it shouldn't. I mean, if you're encrypting the data to send it out, it shouldn't really matter if you're actually encrypting it or not, or you're trying to obfuscate it or something.
Right. Thank you.
Jason, can I ask you another question?
Yep.
John Spring. SCI. I know that our insider threat team has done a lot with the psychological model of insiders and what behavioral patterns they tend to go through when they're exfiltrating data. And this seems to model nicely with that sort of a thing, and that you need the patterns that you're looking for, and this sort of gives you the thing to look for, right? Have you been able to model, besides that these patterns don't match up, that there'd be some broader patterns that you'd be looking for, that you need behavioral access to that sort of a thing, or?
We haven't looked at that, actually, higher level patterns. But I'm actually curious what the psychological patterns that you mentioned. Could you just very briefly discuss what you found?
So I haven't actually done the work. Oh. I know that CERT has, Mike Hanley has a podcast on the CERT website that describes some of what he does. But it's stuff like they often send large email attachments 30 days before they're fired, sort of a thing, to people outside of the organization. There's a lot more fine-grained things, but there's some basic things like that. But just the idea to look for those sort of patterns in sensor networks you often already have instrumented in an enterprise, to be able to go back and see at least what data left, to have some knowledge about exfiltration, which people often, I guess, don't really think about.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about looking at behavioral patterns or like how internal attackers are actually trying to leak out data. That would definitely be something interesting to look into more, and how we could refine our design to take that into account.
Well, one thing I'd add is I think the perception of the need in this space is not primarily driven by insiders, meaning disgruntled employees with privileged access, but by penetration by outsiders who look like insiders. So, stolen credentials or such. And simply because I think the perception is that's the more common threat, even though both exist, both are important, certainly. I actually want to move forward, and then, we can circle back to this as time permits, but I definitely want to touch on all three of the papers. So in the security policies, I really liked how this work just tackles policy head on, because as I was framing, I think that's the thing we have yet to get our heads around, how to make it tractable, and if we were to up level at a meta level, how to publish it. It seems work on policy is just hard to pursue. Period. And Joel, in the paper, you went very quickly over notions of like granularities and compatibility. I wanted, I was just going to invite you to sketch those a little bit more, because I think those relate to how we think about going after policies.
Sorry, do you mean in terms of the existing systems, or what do you mean by?
Yeah, and where to go. Yeah, right. I mean, so, at the end of the paper, you sketch, here's these issues, and a core one is granularity, and another is compatibility.
So in some sense, CSP and Blueprint take a very similar notion of very high-level policies. CSP sort of has a nice idea, which is one policy to rule them all, which is, there's just one policy that if you apply it to any page, indeed it stops cross-site scripting. And boy, that's great, right? Like, you don't see a lot of policies that it's that simple, right? That's it, it's done. And that's a really great idea, but the issue is the inverse of this is now the policy affects how you have to actually implement your system. And so that's sort of what we started to delve into with CSP, is that, you can get this really simple policy that sort of fixes everything, but it turns out there's a trade-off, which is now you have to, adjust your application accordingly. Beep takes a slight turn on that, where it's somewhere in between, where you have this policy of hashes for your programs, or sorry, hashes of your scripts, which is different from every program, but it sort of changes how you have to write your programs
we didn't measure exactly how much that would have to happen, but you can imagine something less than CSP, but more than the others. And then Blueprint, of course, takes the exact opposite approach of you can have these arbitrarily fine-grained policies for your application, and in some sense, you don't have to change your application really to work with this at all. It's you get to write the same application, but you now have to write, in some sense, a shadow application, which is the policy. And I think, you know, we have to figure out what's best, and it's really hard to say. In some ways, to me, the CSP does seem sort of the obvious better approach, especially if you're building something from the ground up, because that way you're building your system ready for CSP.
Let me riff on that for a sec. So, you know, one thing I wonder is whether, you know, integrated system headache, there's some conserved amount of pain you're going to have to do. And some of it can be essentially in the policy part, or some of it can be in the system components and the mechanism. What you were sketching there was a spectrum that, you know, sort of shifts it around. But it does seem there's this other dimension, which is, do you care about backward compatibility or not? Because if you don't, then you may be able to find a new working point in that space.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we started first looking at this problem, we were very interested in a particular claim that we had read in various places that CSP is great because you can just apply it to anything, which is why we started looking at the retrofit case in particular, because we were suspicious of the claim that, you know, you can sort of just trivially apply this to everything. We didn't really look at the issue of building applications with CSP. And it turns out that, I mean, I haven't had any experience with building an application from fresh, but there are a number of major applications now that do implement their applications that they are compatible with CSP. So, for example, Twitter is the really big one, where they, from my understanding at least, they went back and they said, we're going to throw out everything and sort of rebuild it all to work with CSP. And that's great, but, you know, Twitter has a lot of money, so they can do that. And so it's maybe a different scenario. But it also seems like people are having a great time implementing their small applications with CSP as well. And so we were particularly interested in the retrofit case, but it seems promising if you're building an application from the ground up.
Let me actually add some comments to that. We actually had a class, a semester-long class, in which we had, it was a Web2 security class, in which we had, I think, about 15 students who developed Web2 systems from scratch. And we ended up, you know, eventually we ended up in exactly this conversation. We went through all of the different papers talking about all the security, but it all comes down to who defines policy and what does it say. And so I don't think really, you know, the notion that we need HTML client-side policies is really all that controversial. The question is that all these mechanisms, I think Beep and CSP actually kind of move things around on their plate. They're really just being funneled through one place that's making sort of a mega decision about what the policy is. And the problem is that the way, the real value of a lot of these web systems, as we learned in this class, was pulling lots of different pieces from lots of different places. And having any kind of automated process of trying to connect all of these security policies from all the different pieces seemed like a hopeless exercise. So that's my observation. I actually have a question about the paper where you made a big deal about performance, and I'm not really sure I understand why we care.
Sorry, you mean why do we care about performance in web applications?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, browsers are spending, browser vendors are spending millions of dollars to get little tweaks of several percentage points in their JavaScript performance engine. And so when you start seeing hits of 30%, that becomes less acceptable from a very practical standpoint. And one of the authors in the paper, Adam Barth, he works on the Chrome team these days, and he found this was one of the big things for him, was he was really interested in the performance implications of this. And so I do think the performance matters a great deal. Maybe one day it'll all be great and jolly, but, you know, it really has some practical effects, especially when you start talking about smaller devices like Android phones or tablets.
Sure. Okay. So maybe let me ask the question a little bit differently. Is the performance hit because of the way it's being currently implemented, or is there something fundamental about these policy systems that requires an additional 30%? And if so, what is it? Because it seems like an artifact of the environment, not an artifact of the policies.
Right. So part of what we were saying about CSP is that the actual policy enforcement itself. It is trivial, you know. It's a snap. It's one time. It's easy. No problem. Where this performance was coming from, and I'm sorry I didn't have time to give more details about that, but it's sort of in the details, are how you had to rewrite your application. So it's a sort of combination of effects. So assuming you want to write your application in a system that people write their applications in today. which Bugzilla uses. I'm going to get this backwards. I think Bugzilla used the template library, which is a Perl-based web framework, and Hot CRP uses PHP. The way that these systems work, it turns out that putting all of your scripts into external locations has profound effects on how you have to rewrite your application. It means that, for example, one of the major things is that templating logic no longer applies to your scripts, right? Because
so Joel, let me short circuit because we're running low on time. But that sounds like essentially a granularity issue with the policy, because the policy's granularity focuses on files or on URLs or whatever.
Yeah.
Then,
well said.
You know, so potentially one could address that.
Yeah.
And I had following up on Patrick's comment about, you know, you're pulling in all this goop. One thing that just popped in my head as I was, reflecting on the paper and your presentation was, is there room here to think about something essentially like capabilities? So you could picture something like Beep that starts with saying, you know, anybody who can produce this bit string, I bless them. And so now a dynamic script just has to produce the bit string at the beginning of the script saying, hey, this is proof that I came, somehow I got that bit string, and therefore I'm blessed. That would be a sort of specific mechanistic approach. But it seems maybe, you know, by yet another level of indirection, we can address some of this flexibility.
Yeah, I think that's a very compelling idea. I mean, in the particular situation, when I was saying dynamic scripts, what you see is generally not entire scripts being generated, but little parts of scripts being generated. And so to bless this entire script is a little weird, because part of the script, it turns out, is trusted, but then you have this small little portion, which is supposed to be a number or something like that, and that's what you don't trust.
Yeah.
And that's why the dynamic script generation is a little weird, is because it's a combination of a trusted and an untrusted entity. And so, again, it's come back to the granularity of, boy, we don't trust any inline script. And it's like, well, we do. In fact, we trust part of this inline script,
right,
and we don't trust this other part of the inline script. Yeah.
Okay, so given our time, let me move on to the last paper. So I thought about this paper in terms of headache. And well, in terms of... So in particular, right, what's the fix is sort of what I was responding to. And the one you framed was, well, these are sensitive inputs. And I wondered if that's viable, because I could picture I'm going to put some slick game on my phone and it's going to say, I need the gyroscope, or you're not going to get the slickness. And I'm going to say, do it. You get it. And now I've given it this access to this this potentially sensitive input. And so part of it seems maybe there's some angle here to separate out the notion of access to the sensor versus context in which it's being accessed. So I don't want the app to access it when I'm not talking to the app. But when I am, I don't mind. The flip side of this was I also was wondering about, you know, we talked quite a bit about training and what went into the training. And it seems that there's this sneaky opportunity, perhaps, for these apps to do their own training, right? So you could picture the app puts up a little keyboard and says, better key in this secret code, you know, to get to the next level or whatever. And it's busy recording every single sensor. It doesn't just have to be the ones you've identified, just everything. And it can do quite a bit of this and suck up information. It's got ground truth. And now it can do supervised learning on that. And away it goes. So it seems both of those are interesting, and they both sort of boil down to this context, you know, when do you get access? So you want to comment?
So one perhaps quick kind of fix to your question, how do we control it, is that on certain phones, GPS location, there are two different GPS locations. One is coarse location, the other is precise location. So perhaps you can split the sensor data into two, say, coarse data and the precise data. For the games, maybe coarse data is good enough. You don't need that high precision when you try to do the motion-based games. So that
sounds to me brittle. That sounds like, you know, maybe we'll get lucky. But
right, yeah.
But you know, I don't put it past the bad guys to come up with, no, this thing's really cooler if you give me the whole thing.
Hi, Mike Ryan, ISI. Just a comment. You normally, if you grant an application access to a sensor data, it is only allowed to use, or it can only access that data while it's running in the foreground. you'd have to have a pretty malicious piece of software that installs some background process and pretends that it needs it to get it constantly.
Okay, so what is the threat model here?
How at least on Android. I'm sorry. Oh, the threat model now is that this information is currently unrestricted.
Oh, you're saying that should be the policy? Or are you saying that is the policy?
So let me be clear. The policy now is that the information is unrestricted. Any application can access it. I believe that's correct, right?
Yes.
Okay. The policy should be the information is restricted and you have to grant it to specific applications. And if that is actually granted, then you can be fairly certain that these applications cannot use this information in a way that's not during the application.
Right.
So there are ways to circumvent that. So one example is that, so as I mentioned in my talk, the W3C has this request for common, the specification saying that JavaScript in a web page can read the motion data. So if your web page contains malicious JavaScript, then it can read your password that you're typing into your application.
Right, but...
if you have multiple tabs opening.
So in the case of an iPhone... your information data, you can grant the grant the web browser access to your location data, but on a case by case web basis, you can ask the website will request it and you can deny it.
Right.
So this would be just the same case here if you made this data restricted.
Right. So this is related to the question that Vern asked earlier. So how do we control access? So maybe this is one of them. Maybe you should grant access to the motion data website by website rather than granting it to the entire application.
I think I had something else, but that's it.
It does, though. I mean, this every time I get into what should be the rule and that one enforces, I become wary that in the real world you bump up against it for all sorts of reasons that we typically don't anticipate as when we're designing mechanism. This is the bugaboo in my experience of policy. So I could picture it's really actually going to be quite an art to get this right, so that. We understand its security properties and it's not giving away everything, et cetera. And I think it's unfortunate we sort of lack the tools both to find that point in the policy space to suggest right good viable policies and then to analyze whether we're really getting what we want. Seems, these things are lacking in general for many types of security problems that have policy components. I don't know what to do about it myself. Any other comments? Okay, we have, I think, a half-hour break.